Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program as we come your way every Saturday, normally from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time today. And through the next couple of months, April and May, we're going to be coming your way at 6 p.m. Pacific time here on this radio station. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast at a2zen.fm on Sundays at 2 p.m. That's Sundays 2 p.m. Pacific time on a2zen.fm. That is a website. Go to the internet and just type in A, the letter A, the number 2, Z-E-N.fm. And 2 p.m. Pacific time, there we will be replaying this program. I encourage you to check out our archives as well on the radio show's page at richarddugan.com. And we encourage you to participate by sending us an email. We'd like to hear what you think about our guests and their concepts. We encourage you to go to their website. I hope I'm not overloading you with too much information or things to do as if you don't already have enough to do. We do appreciate you taking time out to listen to the program, and we encourage your ears to perk up when you hear something that rings true for you. Well, today's program is rather interesting for me because it is challenging to some degree. It is a challenge to those who are seeking enlightenment. Now, I phrase it this way for myself, that I have been on my search since I was 17 years old. Started with, as I've said many times, the book Autobiography of a Yogi. And read that numerous times and had wonderful opportunities of meeting incredible people over the last, I don't even want to say how many years right now, because I'm not really good at math. But nonetheless, and have always felt that I was in the right place at the right time and finding the information and the insight and the inspiration that I needed, the guidance, the mentorship, if you will, whether it be from individuals or from CDs or books or videos, programs, whatever the case might be. I never latched on to one. For some reason, I guess it's not in my DNA to choose to follow one particular individual, one particular philosophy or concept or belief system. It is looking at a myriad of them. And so for me, I feel as though my path to enlightenment has been a good one. It's been a very productive one, if you will. But that's not always the case. A lot of you are frustrated. Some of you are convinced that you don't have the right stuff to achieve enlightenment in this lifetime, and you're disillusioned by spiritual teachers who don't live up to their lofty self-potentials, as well as you're worrying that choosing a spiritual life means leaving your daily life behind, and you just hunger for a different way to be, but you're unable to express it. And in this day and time that we live, this incredible period of our lives, we're faced with that challenge. Well, my guest today is the author of Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. It's a journey of discovery, snow, and jazz in the soul. And my guest is Robert K.C. Foreman, Ph.D. Welcome to our program, Doctor.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
You know, when I first saw the title, and this was even before I started reading any of the other materials as well as the book, I'm thinking, oh, here we go. Here's the opposite of an apologist, if you will, or apologetics, criticizing the spiritual movements that people are seeking and the enlightenment and metaphysics and all of those different things. And as I began to delve deeper, what I began to notice was, I think, if I'm correct, Robert, that an agnostic is probably one of the best places to be, at least as far as the definition that I'm aware of, and that is an agnostic basically says, I don't know. I'm looking. I'm trying to find the answers, but I don't know. And it's epitomized in the phrase, it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than begin with certainty and end in doubt. So tell me, obviously, you went through some of these same struggles of wondering which way should I go. as I went through an interesting struggle, as I mentioned, not having locked into one particular individual or one particular belief system or philosophy or spiritual practice, and thinking, what am I missing? Why haven't I found that one sage, that one guru, that that one great work of literature, if you will, that will lead and guide me down the road of my life?
You know, I think so many of us were looking for that one bit of wisdom, that one wonderful teacher. I think a lot of people, I've interviewed quite a number of spiritual teachers and leaders, both in preparation for this book and in preparation for a book about the spirituality movement. And what I find is many of us read Paramahansa Yogananda, the autobiography of the yogi. Many of us read Ram Dass.
Mm-hmm.
And we, to some extent, we start out our spiritual quest with a kind of fantasy of what it's all going to produce. And I think that, well, I certainly did. I had this sense that you do your spiritual life, you practice this stuff, maybe you gain enlightenment, and if you do, everything will become perfect, and your life will be terrific, and your business will succeed. And I think there's a huge amount of kind of fantasy and illusion about what the spiritual world and what the spiritual life is going to produce. And so when I titled the book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, what I'm trying to catch there is that there actually is something called enlightenment. It actually is wonderful in its way, but it's not what it's cracked up to be. It's not the fantasy. It's not perfection. It's not a panacea. And what I've tried to do in the book and what I try to do with people that I counsel is to help us all recognize that there really is a value of the spiritual life. The work that you yourself have done that you were describing a couple minutes ago is no doubt wonderful work, but it has not led you to this perfect life. It's not led you into the fantasy. The neon lights haven't gone off. And that finding that kind of in-between place where you both recognize the value of a spiritual life and the value of what we've been doing all these years, but also recognize that there's a fantasy and this doesn't meet the fantasy. I've been trying to walk a kind of narrow ridge between those two. And I like to think I've done reasonably well at it.
Well, you use the analogy of a neon light going off. I've actually purchased those light bulbs that are supposed to last for 100 years.
Yeah.
And within a year and a half, it burns out. And I'm sitting here going,
darn.
And I'm going, wait a minute. And I don't have the receipt. All I have is the bulb. What am I supposed to do now? And I suppose that is a real truth. And what's interesting too, I went to the Conscious Life Expo down in Los Angeles back in February 2012, and the thing that I had an opportunity to sit in on a seminar or a little talk about business, and you know, we're all about new paradigms. We're here trying to find those new ways of living. Those new ways of being, because as I've said many times to folks, if the ways in which we're living today worked, we'd be doing a lot better. That leads me to the conclusion they don't work, so we have to find those new ways. And it's basically that, you know, the ways that we're living today, they don't serve us anymore. They're outmoded and so forth and so on. So anyway, I'm sitting in this lecture, and this woman's talking about business and so forth, and you know, here we are in the 21st century and we have to think differently and on and on and on. And all of a sudden, she said, and the first thing you need to, and she was talking with this one individual, do you have a business plan? And a red flag went off in my head. I go, wait a minute, a business plan? That's part of the old model. You know, now I understand and have been told the purpose and the reason for, and this is getting into more specifics, but for the purpose of a business plan, I understand what that is under the old model. But if we're preparing for the new, for the higher ways of living, don't we have to find those ways? And I guess the key question to you, Robert, is where do we look?
Okay, a couple of things I can comment on there. First of all, I think that one of the problems that we've all faced in the spiritual world, in this new paradigm business world, in the world of, you know, this is the next wave of thinking. I think there's a great deal of hype in these presentations and a great deal of hype in these worlds. And I think that we need to kind of find our way through the hype and start to recognize there really is some value in the middle. There is a baby in the middle of the bathwater, and we have to be able to find it and identify it. For me, and here I think is more the question that you're kind of pointing to, I think there actually is a key trick. And let me back up for 1 second and see if I can get this to you. First of all, I think the experience of enlightenment is an experience of openness, of a sense of spaciousness in your life, a sense of being present, and a sense of, I don't know, safety in the middle of things that are hard. Now, have you ever had the experience? I'm sure you have, so I'm asking you to kind of look in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had the experience in which you were with a very dear friend, and you've been keeping something kind of to yourself for your whole lifetime, keeping something that's been true about you, something you might be a little, I don't know, have been afraid to tell somebody or a little afraid of? Have you ever had the experience of telling a friend that, sir?
Yeah, I have.
And what's it like after you tell the secret?
It's liberating in one sense.
It's liberating.
It's freeing.
And so, yes, it's freeing. One person described it to me as it's like a rock has been on your chest and you lift the rock off your chest. Yeah, this kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, I think the key act, and if we talk about new paradigms, I would point here. I think the key act in becoming a freer human being has to do with being willing to tell the real truth, to tell those truths that you've been kind of keeping to yourself, to really be honest with yourself and to speak out or to say at least to yourself what is really the case and what you have not been able to say. And it always, always, always leads to a sense of freedom, a sense of openness, a sense of honesty. And that sense of openness, honesty, and freedom is, first of all, quite parallel to the experience of enlightenment. But even more important than that, it is, I think, how we get out of our old way. The old way has to do with living what many people call in the box. And to tell the truth, you're getting out of the box.
Yeah.
And I think that if we can learn to live our lives in such a way that we are telling more and more of the truth and doing it in a way that's more consistent and ever so much deeper in an ongoing way, I think it's right there that our lives can become freer. I would point to truth-telling as the key act in what you've called the new paradigm. Yeah?
Yeah. That's very interesting. And there are some cathartic moments that we have that can propel us there. I'm going to share this now. Some time ago, someone said, you know, you need to stop sharing your personal life on your program because people are just not really going to relate. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I've been doing that. If somebody has been following my, and God knows, I hope nobody has been, following my career for the last 34 years of broadcasting for me and interviewing in the last 34 years, they probably could write my biography because I have shared so much of my life. Anyway, I had an experience actually this week. I was out at the wharf here in Santa Barbara where I live, and I was walking out to the end of the wharf, and I'm enjoying all that there is to enjoy out there. That's one of the reasons that I moved here. And this wave of sadness came over me. And I found a place along the side of the wharf behind one of the restaurant structures, what have you, and tears just came down my eyes. And I was just overwhelmed by this sadness and trying to identify, where is this coming from? This was what was going through my mind. And it was a combination of sadness over my inability as a single individual to help to fix and or change and or assist in the changing of other people's lives in an extremely direct way. And the thing that comes to mind is specifically is what's been going on for what I found out was been over a year in Syria. And just the atrocities that are going on there and man's inhumanity to men. And of course, bringing it closer to home and so on and so forth. And I shared this with someone and they said, you know, that's very interesting because really what you have to realize is, yeah, that's a wonderful sentiment and it's beautiful that you felt that way and the tears and all of that. But you have to remember that their suffering is their suffering and you have your own. And that doesn't mean we don't care about one another. That was not the point. But I actually felt like, you know, I needed to do that. Whether it came from sadness or exuberation and joy over where I was and what I was experiencing on that afternoon. Emotional expression, is that from your perspective and your experience part of the road to or on enlightenment?
Yes, I would say that to be able to touch into our honest emotion, and when you know, as you began to tell this story and you described your own sadness, I would say that I've also struggled with the sense of sadness that sort of comes up. And I think that it is very freeing to sit with it as opposed to running from it. You had two choices there when you went for your walk. One choice was, you could have run away from it. You could have said, oh no, I don't want to feel that. And you could have gotten preoccupied with something else. You could have made yourself busy. But what you did, and here I want to compliment you for it and compliment you for telling the story, what you did is you simply sat with it and said, now what is this about? What am I feeling? And you began to explore the real truth within yourself. I remember an experience that I had that was quite similar to that, where I was also struggling with a sense of being somewhat sad or depressed, and I went up to a park near my house, and I sat on a park bench overlooking the Hudson River, and I tell this story in Enlightenment AIM what it's cracked up to be. I sat on a park overlooking the river, and I realized I was struggling with the thought that I was failing. I was failing, I wasn't successful, and whatnot. I'm actually a reasonably successful guy, but I was really struggling with something at the time. And I sat there, and so what I did was I said to myself, I am failing. And that was such a hard sentence to say, but I was able to simply sit with it. And so I realized there was real juice in there for me. So I said, I'm failing. And that became a kind of mantra. I went up there every day for about 2 weeks, and I realized that there was something about that I was really running from. And I think all of us feel that there's things in our world we feel helpless about. We feel like we can't help. Or we're not good enough, or we are ashamed of who we are. And I think that the tendency in all of us is to run from it. But I think the real healing, and here is I would point towards the path towards freedom, the real healing comes in telling ourselves the real truth about what we're feeling, what's really going on, who we actually are in our worlds. And I think that this is very important. What you've done when you went out to the pier, as you did, what you've done is you've simply said, no, here I actually am, and I'm struggling with this, and you open yourself up to your own life. And in that sense, you stop running from it. You stop running from the fear that you are incapable of helping others. You stop running from whatever it is that's been making you so sad. And I think that this is where real health comes in. It comes in telling the truth, and it comes in expressing what's really true for us. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. This may be putting the cart before the horse. We may have already addressed this, but I'm going to ask this question based upon, I mean, as I was looking not only through the book, but also just perusing the chapter titles, the one question that comes to mind is, Robert Forman, author of Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, what is it?
Well, here, I'll tell you my story, since that's what you like to do. I was 22. I'd been meditating for a few years. I was on a 9-month meditation retreat. And something happened inside my body. It was in the back of my neck. And it was as if a kind of tube opened up rather suddenly, just like with a little zipper sort of quality. A tube opened up. And inside the tube had been something like static. Something like noise. And yet when it opened up the way it did, or this little zipper quality happened, that little tube became dead silent, absolutely silent. And when I say dead silent, what I mean is there was really no sound in it, and yet it felt very lively. It felt very open. It felt almost spacious. And over the next month or so, that sense of openness and spaciousness would open into the tubes in the back of my neck one after the next, after the next, after the next, until after the next, until finally this whole back of my skull had become this sense of silent, spacious, free openness. And that sense of openness, I think, is what many people experience at the depths of their meditation, when they have something called, in Zen Buddhism, called Satori or Moksha in Hinduism. These are experiences in which people are describing a similar sense of openness that came about for me back in 1972. And so that the sense of it is, there's a kind of peculiar level, a sense of openness beneath your thoughts, beneath your emotions, beneath what has been the only thing you've known. And that sense of openness is what Christians would call the divine, what Hindus would call Brahman, what Buddhists would call Buddha mind. And when I got my PhD in the study of religion, I ended up seeing story after story about people that had similar experiences. So I've come to the conclusion that what the religious traditions are describing is this sense of openness, the sense of freedom behind your thoughts, behind your feelings. And so that it, and each chapter uses the word it, and if you'll recall, the font of the word it is very fancy. We're trying to communicate something about, we think about it as being fancy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each religious tradition has a kind of view of what this sense of silence is that becomes very fancy and almost fanciful. And yet I think it's of value, even though it's, I think it's not what people sort of imagine and sort of fantasize about it. Nevertheless, I think this is really of value. And so it is that sense of spacious openness that can come onto a person temporarily for a few hours or minutes or even days, or permanently, as it does for quite a number of people that I've spoken with. So the sense of it is that sense of the spacious, silent openness beneath your thoughts that allows you to sort of hold or witness your thoughts in a new context. You understand? Am I being clear enough?
I do, and it brings to mind a conversation that I had with a physicist who wrote a book called The Fifth Dimension. And he used to tell me, we went for walks on occasion, and he used to tell me, he says, I can describe to you and prove to you the existence of the first and the second and the third, the first and the second dimensions, and even the third dimension, height, width, depth. I can prove to you the effects of the fourth dimension. But then he went off into the fifth dimension. This kind of goes into what you're talking about, because as he began to describe to me what the fifth dimension was, how it worked and so forth, from his understanding as a physicist and having worked for myself for over 15 years, and I sort of have an unofficial PhD in Christian studies because I worked for a Christian radio station for 15 years, best education I was ever paid for. And as we're walking along the streets of Santa Barbara and he finished telling me and describing to me about the fifth dimension, I stopped and said, there's only one word that I can use to describe what you just shared with me. And it's one word that people would know, and that's God. The way he described it, the way he put it together, even in scientific terms, I understood. And he used to talk about how each individual cell of the body, the trillions of cells, they carry out their various jobs and their duties and so on and so forth. And his key question was, where are they getting their instruction from? Where are they getting the information to do what they do? Just as you and I, we get our instruction from somewhere. And I have to wonder if that isn't back behind the thoughts and emotions. It's that undercurrent, if you will. And if tapping into that, even as you say, for just an instant, for a moment, and if we can train ourselves and work towards staying in connection with it longer, that's maybe what enlightenment is? Question mark.
Yes, there's a lot I'd like to comment on here, and it's almost too much. First of all, in the physics that I've studied, and you apparently, and certainly this man knows more than either of us, but the physics that I've studied, which is not enough, I've come to understand that there's a quantum ground state beneath the way atoms work and beneath the energy behind quarks.
Mm-hmm.
And the quantum ground state is, or vacuum state, is omnipresent. It's everywhere. And out of it, the atoms come and the quarks come, and there's a kind of expression of that energy, and they think that out of that quantum ground state also the Big Bang began. And I sometimes think that the sense of spacious openness that people can experience sounds an awful lot like the quantum vacuum state or this ground state. It is spacious. You have a sense of it being beneath the world and beneath what there is of things. And I think, I know I've had experiences of this, and I think there are many other people that have, that say that what we experience in what's called mystical experiences, or what we experience in spiritual experiences, is quite the same, quite similar, as this quantum ground state or this sense of openness. And then you went on to ask the question of, could this be giving instructions to our thoughts and instructions to our neurophysiology and whatnot? And I want to say that one of the things I mention in Enlightenment 8, what it's cracked up to be, but also in other books I've written, is that I think the word consciousness itself is what I would want to point to as the kind of instructions, doesn't sound quite right, but the kind of general direction behind things. Consciousness is kind of pointing us towards the direction of our life. And so what I think is that sense of openness that one experiences in both spiritual experiences and in enlightenment is one is experiencing one's own open consciousness. And in that sense, I think that what you have is something that does look like God. It does look like the divine because it's everywhere, and yet it sort of stands behind our thoughts. And I think that enlightenment is an experience of one's own consciousness, the kind of openness or spread outness of one's own consciousness. Does this make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I want to dive into another area as we continue talking here on the program. This is Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest is Dr. Robert Casey Forman. He is the author of many works, but this one we're talking about, Enlightenment 8, What It's Cracked Up to Be, A Journey of Discovery, Snow, and Jazz in the Soul. He's authored a number of other books, but he's also made an opportunity for you to participate in the discussion, if you will, by providing a website that you can go to and share your observations of disillusionment as well as your profundities, your epiphanies, if you will. And you can go to enlightenment8.com. There's a couple of other websites we'll tell you about as well, or you can also email him, share your ideas, office@theforge, theforge.org. And I wanted to dive into another area because we're going down a road here. I think that it's extremely important. Now, I don't know, many of my guests don't watch television, and there are times when I wish I didn't. But there are some programs that I have watched that I have. I had a good friend at the religious station I worked for, and he and I used to have wonderful conversations about the television series Star Trek, specifically The Next Generation, and how he viewed it, and I began viewing it, as our modern-day mythology. And as I began to think about the various episodes and their messages and their intertwined stories and conflict resolution and so forth, it just made perfect sense, especially considering the fact that I haven't read anything of the Greek gods and Greek tragedies and all of this mythology that I hear people talking about from time to time. But the one particular aspect that I want to dive into, interestingly enough, ties into what would be considered the enemy in this series, near the end of the series and even into several movies, and that's the Borg and their collectiveness and how each individual carries out a task, but they're doing it for the collective. I want to bring that back to what you just spoke about before our break. In that, the instructions, that underlying current behind thoughts and feelings that I have spoken about with people and say, look, you know, we always talk about following your intuition. And this, by the way, Robert, this is the one guarantee that I make to people. It's the only one I will ever make in my life. And that is that if you follow that still small voice, the intuition, whatever you want to call it, it will never, ever, ever, ever steer you in the wrong direction. Now, that's not just listening to it, following the promptings. It just won't. It may challenge you, but it will not send you in a direction to where you will be hurt or injured, etc., etc. So with that said, let me ask you about that undercurrent. In the light of us as individuals, in this world, there are over 7 billion of us living individual lives. But many of us, you and I would be included, we're trying to listen to the promptings and follow them to go in a direction that will hopefully give us a fulfilled life. Not necessarily money and fame and cars and women and so on and so forth, but give us the thing that we really, really deep down inside really want. That undercurrent, you know, I would describe maybe as God, the universal power. And what it brings me to as a conclusion, Robert, is that we do and we don't really have a choice in the matter if we're following that. Because that undercurrent has a greater plan, a bigger picture than we could ever comprehend. Is that a fair assessment?
I love the way you're putting that, Richard. And I want to say this, that I think that we all have this sense of what is deeply so for us. And when you're describing this intuition or the still small voice, the way I would describe that is, if I can allow myself to let go of the raps that I generally give myself, the talk that I have been talking since I've been a kid, and pay attention to what is more deeply true for me, more deeply so, I think that that is very close to what you're describing as this still small voice or the sense of intuition. And the closer I can get to that sense of what I really am or who I really am, the more in alignment I can become with those deeper impulses in me. And I think that what happens in enlightenment, and I think that what you're describing, is you're describing a life that you get closer and closer to that deeper sense of what we're about. For me, the word silence kind of carries a good bit of it. That is to say, when I really listen into the silence, I start to get a little clearer direction, a little clearer sense of where I should be going. And I think for me, that's it. Now, I also want to comment on this thing about the Borg. The Borg is a very interesting image. For those that are not familiar with Star Trek, the Borg is this sort of collective, and they are constantly sort of sweeping people into themselves and, as it were, swallowing up individuality. And I think that that's... I think if you also think about the Star Trek Enterprise image that comes in that Next Generation, those people are very attentive to who one another is, what's going on. There is a certain kind of collectivity that's there. So what you have is collective that destroys individuality versus collective that, as it were, welcomes individuality. And I think what we're about in our culture, and this is why that TV show seemed to work so well for so many people, and I loved it myself, that I think that what it's pointing to is the possibility of being both an individual and valuing one's individuality and also valuing the fact that we are together. I think that if we can really listen into each other, there's a kind of open collective consciousness that starts to emerge that's not instead of our individuality, but rather includes our individuality and includes our sense of what we are. So I think what we're about is finding that common sense of ground, the common sense of openness, without destroying individuality that we all love and cherish in ourselves. And I think what I'm doing in the book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, there's a long section in there, as you know, about what it is to join in with others at this level of honesty, openness, and truth-telling. And I think that I like to think that it could be as truly safe and truly open as that rather fantasized but glorious sense of togetherness that you saw on that TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I do think that what we're about is discovering the common ground, but without losing the sense of individual autonomy and authenticity that makes us what we are as people.
And I've often taken a look at the human body on a cellular level, the trillions of cells, as I spoke of earlier in the program, and I've asked the question, under what system of government, for lack of a better term, do those cells function? And I have to start out by telling the person I'm sharing this with, the first one you get to throw out is democracy, because those trillions of cells, if they lived under a democratic form of government, each one would want to be individual, call their own shots, and the body would cease to exist. Unfortunately, it tends to lead in a direction that people don't want to go. And I'm not saying, and again, this is it's a modified concept. I'm still working on it myself as far as being able to describe it. But, you know, there are only three basic ones that I'm aware of that we talk about in this day and time. And that is democracy, socialism, and communism. And it's not necessarily communism, but it is some form of socialism, because you can actually use the comparison of our military. Military is a socialist system that functions for a specific reason and purpose, and that you cannot have individuals going off doing their own thing, being rogue soldiers, if you're trying to accomplish a task. Whether it's building a bridge as civil engineers or, you know, in combat. So the human body and even nature, the universe, functions under a system, and the only word I could come up with, Robert, was interdependentism. Too hard to say, too hard to remember. So I thought of just calling it blue-green, but that doesn't say anything to anybody.
I think that interdependent is a very interesting word there, but I want to add one thing. And if you think about the military, it's actually a nice example. What happens in the military is that you have a boss. You have a general, a sergeant, a major. You have somebody that's actually instructing the gang how to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our bodies need that. We need to know what the direction is that we are going as a whole. It's not a democracy. It's not my hand with my foot about where I'm going to go. Rather, it's me, my sense of who I am, my consciousness. And the clearer we can be on what our consciousness is, the clearer we can be about what we actually are at the depths, the more powerfully we can direct the thing as a whole and do it in a way that's coordinated or integrated. So that I think truth-telling helps this. I think meditation helps this. I think that living a life in which we are ethical helps this. So all of these things, I think, play a role in having our lives be coordinated. And I am quite sure, and here I don't, this is, what we're talking about is beyond what neurophysiologists know, but I am quite sure that the consciousness, however that is produced in us, and we scholars don't know yet, but however consciousness is produced, that consciousness itself is, in effect, the general of our system as a whole, or the president of our system. So no, it's not a democracy. It has to be something like a dictatorship of those who agree to function together or to function interdependently. And I think that it's in their consciousness is playing the leadership role that I think so many of our governments actually need. But it's an interesting image you bring up. I'm quite interested in what you're saying.
Well, I've been pondering it for quite some time, only because I've kind of seen the direction that some of the isms, whether they be religious or political or military, have gone. And again, the continuation of man's inhumanity to man. And it kind of raises the next part of the conversation that I have been asking for about 2 years now. Now, I share with people that on this program, I don't have a set of questions. The universe asks the questions. I'm just along for the ride. And I was sitting in an interview one afternoon, and we were chatting away, and in the back of my mind, whether that was under the thoughts and feelings, I don't know, but in the back of my mind, this question just was nagging at me. It would not go away. And of course, my mind was going, oh, no, wait a minute. I can't ask that question. It's not pertinent to the conversation at hand. And it wouldn't go away and wouldn't go away. And we went to break. And I told the gal, I says, I have a question I have to ask you in the next segment and so forth. So I did. So I put this question to you, and I will summarize it by putting it this way. If we are here in a collective context, as far as that still small voice and following the guidance and so forth, then what is humanity here to achieve? And I'm not speaking in the more philosophical and metaphysical spiritual constructs. The last time that I am aware in my lifetime that a large number of the members of our species got together to achieve something was during the space program. Yes, there was the space race, but we were all, every time we or they launched a rocket with men, the world held its breath. And we all watched and we all waited. And when they came down, we breathed again and we were exuberant at not only that achievement, but the things that they had discovered. And collectively, we achieved something. And that's the last time I can recall the population of this planet on any numbers, of any percentage, ever achieved something in that sense. So that's where that question goes to. I'm not saying let's build the Tower of Babel. We saw what happened there. From your perspective, what are we here to achieve?
You know, that's actually, I mean, that you're asking it in a way that I haven't, but it's actually a question I've been struggling with for the last 10 years or so of my life. And so I'd like to respond out of that kind of long-term pondering of this. I used to think that my life and our life collectively was really oriented around achieving something externally, achieving something out in the world. And I think that achieving something, writing a book, getting your name in the paper, building a business, building a government, I think those are wonderful things to do. And I'm very pleased that I've had the opportunity to do quite a number of them. But I've come to the conclusion that to think that there's something exterior to ourselves that's the key, I think that has been a mistake for me. And where I've gone with it is I've come to the conclusion that what I'm really after is a life lived fully, a life lived openly, a life lived so that I am fully aware of what I'm doing and yet not demanding that it goes a particular way. You were saying earlier in the show something about that if one listened to the still small voice, that one is always going to be directed in a direction that's pretty sane and is not going to hurt you. And I think that what the discovery for me has been, and I think it's something that I'm trying to point to in Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, I think the discovery has been, can I live my life in such a way that I'm fully present, fully open, and yet not demanding so much of my life, but rather enjoying it for what it is. I think that something that has been a huge deal for me, my ambition, my desire to be well-known, my desire to be well-to-do, I think all of those things have been a certain kind of trap. And I've been working in the last 10 years especially to let go of the trap of thinking there was something outside of myself that was what I should be achieving, and to learn to live in my life in such a way that I'm fully present, fully open, and fully real at all times. And so I would take your question and I would say that I'm not convinced that there's something outside of ourselves that we should be working to achieve, but rather should be working to achieve a life in which we are fully cognizant of what's going on and living our lives in such a way that we really are listening to that still small voice. So that's kind of what I've been coming up with in the last 10 years. Does this make sense to you?
Makes good sense to me, yes. As a matter of fact, what's interesting is what you bring to mind is the phrase, the paradox that you present to my question, what is humanity here to achieve? The destination is the journey. That the destination is the journey. And
yeah, and can you actually be so present to the journey? Can you be so fully in your life that you actually are living it and know that you're living it fully, living it well, and so the destination that you're after is to be able to, and this takes a good bit of work and a good bit of self-discipline, but to be able to be fully present in what you are or in what you're doing in a way that actually you are present. You are fully there. So, yeah. In that sense, the destination, where what I'm after, is being able to live my life fully. Can I read you a little passage from the book
please,
about this?
Please do.
And, okay, and this is on page 2.
All right. And I just want to let our listeners know that this is from Enlightenment 8, What It's Cracked Up to Be, with my guest, Robert Forman. And again, it is a journey of discovery, snow, and jazz in the snow. I beg your pardon. I did read that correctly. And jazz in the soul. Go ahead and share with us what you have there.
Yeah, this comes towards the end of Enlightenment, what it's cracked up to be, and I say this. Rather than happiness, in the end, what you get, and here I'm thinking about what you're saying in your question, Richard, but rather than happiness, in the end, what you get is to become ever more real. You get to stand bent under the burdens of fewer and fewer of your own lies. With your feet planted ever more deeply in the soil of what is so, you get to become ever more vertical, and you get to discover with and to invite others who wish to do the same. What the spiritual path offers, and in fact I would say what life as a whole offers, is not unmingled happiness, it is not the conventional, and it is not the end of ambition. Nor is it camaraderie or ease, though these may come. What you get is to be increasingly open to the joy and the melancholy that is the deeply lived life. In the end, you get to be increasingly alive, the mystery coursing up your spine. You get to be more awake, more deeply honest, freer, and to stand up straighter and straighter in it. You get to be, in all its ancient simplicity, a human being. And I think for me, that captures this sense of being fully present in your life, so that the destination is to be fully present in the journey. I think what you're pointing to is exactly right. That's exactly where I'm going. Yeah.
I had a lot of different answers. So far, I think I like this one the best. And it is one in which, well, my experience on the wharf the other day is, I think, an example of that. I was enjoying, but of course there was stuff going on inside as well, and I was able to assimilate both of those into my experience that afternoon. It is, to say the very least, somewhat profound. I know that I've heard a lot of people say, you know, that the best way to do this whole spiritual thing is just keep it simple. You know, we are trying to make it so complex, and it's not complex. And then they write a book. or two or three. And I'm going, wait a minute.
200 pages trying to say something simple. Yes,
and didn't you say you were supposed to keep it simple? The other thing, too, that I've heard, too, is if you want to, you know, enjoy the journey, get back to nature. Recenter yourself. Get back to nature. And that's why I'm always going back to the examples of nature. I'm very fortunate in the place in which I live, not just in Santa Barbara, but I live in a rural area on the mountain above. And, you know, we have wild turkeys going through the property. We have chickens, dogs, cats, and so on and so forth. And it's a wonderful experience. But when things are quiet and the highway's quiet in the late evening, we're sitting out on the porch and just listening and feeling the air and so forth and so on. it is, that is kind of what I think people are talking about, giving us the opportunity to not just rest, but to reflect if need be, but also to look around and observe and experience what the body is experiencing through all of the senses.
Yeah, I think if there's, you know, you talk about being simple, and I think if there's a kind of simple conclusion that I want to invite people to, I would say that what I'm actually after, what the book Enlightenment, what it's cracked up to be, is really pointing to, is to be fully present in your life, as I was just reading. And the key act to getting fully present is to be as honest as you can be, and increasingly honest over time. And I think it sounds so simple, it sounds so obvious, but I think honesty, telling the real truth about what's going on, telling the real truth about who you are, allows you to be more and more present in your life, more and more open. So your description of sitting on a porch and my description of sitting on a park bench overlooking the Hudson River near in New York where I live, I think that both of us are pointing to something where, can you be fully in the moment? And the key act of being fully in the moment is telling yourself the real truth about what's going on, about who you really are, what you're actually feeling. I think those are the keys for me.
And it leads me to my final two questions of our program. Who is Robert Forman?
Well, if I tell you the real truth, I would have to say the silence is what Robert Casey Forman is all about. And I can point to that in a way that I did not used to be able to point to it. So that's sort of the wrong answer. I think you were probably looking for me to give you a resume, but
No. Whatever you give.
It's much more true.
Yeah. No, it's I have no prerequisites.
What happened to me, and I want to stress this. So what happened to me back in 72 was I went through a change, and this change I was describing to you with the little tubes in the back of my head. Before then, if you'd asked me who was Robert Forman, I would have said, oh, I don't know, me. But afterwards, I realized that what I really am is the silence, and that's a huge shift. It was a huge shift for me back then, and it's remained with me. And only gotten more and more amplified and bigger. The sense of silence has gotten bigger and more connected to the rest of the world. So, yeah, I would have to answer it in a way that's like that. It sounds kind of abstract, and it's not an easy thing to say, but nevertheless, I think that's about as true as I can get right there.
And you've probably answered this question in a number of different ways throughout the program, but directly, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve with the work you're doing?
That's a very interesting question for me right now because, as I said a little while ago, my sense of ambition has sort of changed. And I have this wonderful introduction to the book as I've reread it recently, I feel pretty good about it. And that is, what I attempt to do in Enlightenment 8, what it's cracked up to be, and what I attempt to do in everything that I do, is I attempt to represent real truth, to speak the truth as deeply and as clearly as I know it. And I think speaking the truth is a wonderful way to be. One of the things that I've discovered is that when I speak my truth, other people want to speak theirs. So when I'm with a friend, when I'm in a group, to speak out the truth seems to have a kind of invitation to it, to have other people do it. A lot of people have given me feedback about the book since it's come out, and it didn't come out that long ago. A lot of people have given me feedback about the book that as they were reading my story, my truth, they began to tell themselves their own story. They began to see their own journey in a freer, more honest light. And that's very gratifying to me. I want to be a beacon for truth-telling in the world. I want to be a beacon for that openness. I thought that what I was after in the spiritual life was enlightenment. I thought I was after some interesting experience, but I think the key of enlightenment is to be fully present in what you actually are, and truth-telling, I think, is a wonderful, perhaps the best way to get to that. So if there's one thing I want to be in the world, and if there's one thing I've attempted to communicate in both my book and also in this conversation, this delightful conversation with you, by the way, is that I want to be a beacon for truth-telling. And I want to help people have the courage to tell their own truths to their friends, their relatives, etc. And that, I think, is worth doing. And that's what I really want to be about. Mm.
Robert Forman, thank you so much for sharing with us your book and yourself, your time, and this hour with us. This has been fabulous. And I hope that one day, if you happen to be in the area, Santa Barbara area, please look us up. We'd love to sit down and chat in studio. It'd be wonderful to have you in studio.
I would very much love doing that. But I also want to say one thing to you, and that is I want to compliment you for what you do. There is so much hype on the radio, and there's so much hype in our society. And what I see you doing is to attempt to tell, to have real conversations with people about the things that actually do matter. And I know how hard it is to do this, and you do it year after year, and you do it very well. You do it in a way that has made me feel very comfortable, but also you've invited me to go as deeply as you can into who I am and what I'm about. And I compliment you for it. And I really, my hat is off to the work that you do. And so thank you very much. Thank you for doing what you do in the world, but also thank you for having me on your show.
Well, again, my thanks for the kind words. The title of the book, again, is Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be, A Journey of Discovery, Snow, and Jazz in the Soul. Robert Forman, my guest. And of course, you can go to enlightenmentaint.com. There's also godeepertogether.org and theforge.org. Encourage you to check out Robert's information, his books, and his journey as well. And we're linked to his website, and we encourage you to check all that out. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time. Love to Lal.